Warning: this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
Because if anyone doesn't know how short life is, it ought to be me. You know, if anyone knows how short life is, it ought to be me. Because I had taken the lives of six young people. Suddenly, unexpectedly, and I almost lost my life for myself. Had this guy cut a jugular vein, which he tried to do, I wouldn't be here now.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, but for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Bill and Jack in conversation. Bonus episode 2, Letters with Berkowitz, part 1.
What are we looking at here, Jack?
Looking at one of the first letters I received from Berkowitz, in which he invited me to visit him, not as a friend, but as a journalist. So he obviously was seeking to use me as a conduit for this important information he had for saving the world he had tried to destroy.
You mind reading some of it to us?
Okay. Dear Jack, letters dated February 7th, 1980. Dear Jack, I'm really looking forward to a visit with you as soon as possible. I think I have a lot, all one word, to tell you. However, it doesn't really concern my case. Mainly, it's about the Attica riot of 1971. I have two typewritten letters totaling 20 pages, which I want to send to Governor Kerry as soon as possible. But as expected, I'm getting flack from the superintendent. Since this place has come to a virtual standstill, I can't get over to the library to make photocopies. This puts me in quite a jam. Basically, I want to begin a campaign for victims of violent crimes in this state. This would include the survivors of those who died. Of course, this is most difficult to explain in this short letter, but you won't be disappointed. I don't know if you're on my visitors list yet. However, I would ask that you come in as a reporter and not just a friend. If you have any questions, then feel free to ask them when and if we meet. Sincerely, David Berkowitz.
Okay, and now, why was he writing you?
He had read and contacted me previously about a series of stories I had done on mental health and the criminal justice system. This related directly to the deinstitutionalization that the genius Ronald Reagan was involved in at that time of incarcerated mentally ill people and emptying out all of these hospitals for people with psychiatric disorders.
Defunding mental institutions.
Right, right. And they did the same thing in the prison systems all over the country. And the so-called criminally insane were taken from special facilities, as the one called Marcy in New York State mm-hmm. used to be, and putting them in general population prisons like Attica. And this was a few years after the riots. And the superintendent I thought was a pretty reasonable fellow at that time. He saw problems brewing when they began putting schizophrenic and paranoid people in with just plain mean criminals. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of violent incidents, and including fatal incidents. And I approached him about working sort of undercover as a counselor for violent inmates inside the prison, which I did for about a month, and wrote a series of letters that we won a number of awards for. Berkowitz read those letters and wrote to this woman that he had been corresponding with to have her get in touch with me first about possibly visiting him.
Now, you called them letters, but you mean articles that you wrote about
Right. I did. It was like a 5-day series of stories of working with these guys inside Attica and telling their stories of what put them there and describing incidents of violence and of, you know, how the guards had to be on hyper alert. They had tried to isolate these the most severely psychotic onto one company, but there were problems even there when they had to move back and forth with the general population to the chow hall, to the exercise yard, and that sort of thing.
And this was this had come about as the result of the defunding. The national defunding of mental institutions. And
right.
This is a separate string of articles than the ones that you wrote previously on incarcerated vets.
Right, right.
Okay, cool. Yeah, right. And this was for the Rochester Democrat Chronicle, is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And David read those.
Right.
And what was his reaction as you saw it?
He was very complimentary. You know, he thought that they, you know, gave an insight into the minds of people like himself. Mm-hmm. And since he was a prominent occupant of that institution at that time, he began looking around. These guys are kind of borderline personalities. They all think of themselves as, you know, writers and journalists too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he saw me as someone he could collaborate with.
We don't see that. We see that a lot, even in the year that he was murdering, that this writer kind
right.
of complex,
right?
Right, because you could see there's. I almost don't want to use the word joy, but you can see some kind of enjoyment in the writing of the letters, his letters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's shaping some ideas that are greater than the effort that it took right. to just pick up a gun and put bullets in it and go kill a random anonymous person. You know, this was giving all this meaning somehow.
Right. To a truth that was in a way much more simpler and much less. Didn't have any kind of positive spin to it at all. It's an unchecked anger and unchecked internal situation.
Right, right. Yeah. It was, it's like dropping a match somewhere, you know, it's an extension of the, you know, malicious arson that he had done throughout his childhood. Mm-hmm. It was just taking it
many steps further. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he mentions Attica prison riot in this letter. Can you walk us through that for people who are not familiar with what that was, when it occurred? Can you tell us what year it occurred and what
happened? Yeah, 1971. In fact, the newspaper won a Pulitzer Prize for the coverage of that, because the state correction and this awful governor we had at that time, Nelson Rockefeller, some people might remember, refused to negotiate after prisoners had been double and triple bunked.
Mm-hmm.
prison is a, you know, hard enough place to be. And I talked to some of the guards afterward who said that the inmates were, you know, within their, that they were driven to desperation and pretty much had to riot. Among other things, you know, being denied food, being triple bunked, and they were given as toilet paper, 4 sheets of toilet paper a day, and that was supposed to be all they needed to clean themselves and maintain proper toilet hygiene. It was described as being a place like, you know, some third world prison where they dump people and just want society to forget them. Anyway, there was a riot. I think it was 3 days that they demanded that the governor come and meet with them to discuss issues like only being given 4 squares of toilet paper a day. And the governor refused to do it. Instead, sent in state troopers to retake the prison, who laid down a fog of tear gas when they came in, wearing masks. Some of these guys had gone home and got their own private hunting rifles just to go in and blaze away. Anyway, in the end, I think it was 58 guards and prisoners were killed. The guards and prisoners were all huddled together behind desk and furniture, whatever they could find, to try to protect themselves from this this slaughter by New York State troopers. And just as many guards, or maybe more guards than inmates, died. And the state official line was these dozens of prison guards who were killed were murdered by inmates, when in fact they were killed by the state troopers. There was only one guard that they established had been killed by an inmate who was holding him on a tower and let him fall. And when our newspaper reported that from the medical examiner who was there examining the bodies, revealing that they were in fact killed by guards, a couple of our guys won.
How do we know that that's not the case? That, you know, you said that the official word was that the inmates were, of course, doing the killing. But how do we know that that's not the case of what happened?
Autopsies reveal that in every case but one, every fatality was caused by a bullet matched to the state troopers' rifles and handguns.
Okay, and then what was the effect, what kind of effect did that have on the country and on you personally when word of this got out?
Well, I wasn't surprised because my son was born on the day of the Kent State murders. And because of the way the country was, this near authoritarian rule, particularly that Republican governors like James Rhodes of Ohio, who ordered the murder of students at Kent State who were peacefully protesting. And actually, this prison takeover would have remained fatality-free had we not had another authoritarian wannabe for a governor like Nelson Rockefeller, who ordered force rather than even attempt to negotiate and defuse a violent situation. And it was just one more example of what a horrible country our United States of America was becoming under this rule by, again, Republican political leaders.
Because it was huge national press, right?
International.
Right.
I mean, this was the murder by state troopers of almost 60 human beings. In fact, you know, more died later, so this was the final toll was well over that, and all of those guys, you know. I was amazed at how much sympathy the guards who were held hostage by those guys had for the inmates. They said, you know, they had a lot more love for the prisoners than they did for the governor who ordered the massacre or for any of the police officers who took part in it.
Because you were there, you were dispatched by your paper to cover that prison and to speak with the guards in case another incident occurred, correct?
I was there after the riot. I began writing for the newspaper a couple of years after that riot. And I took a keen interest in the prison for several reasons, maybe one, my own history, you know, there, but for the grace of God, I could have been an inmate or even a guard. There were a number of Vietnam veterans who were incarcerated during that era, guys who had come back from Vietnam with no debriefing, no decompression, who wound up committing usually violent crimes and winding up in places like Attica. It was a very large population at that time. And the guards had gone on strike a couple of years later because of the working conditions and because of the things that I went back in to investigate in 1979, 1980 of housing mentally ill prisoners in an institution already chock full of violent offenders. And after the riot, the state had promised that there would never be double and triple bunking again, and they started doing it again.
Do you think the national effect of the riot was that it kind of put a spotlight on the prison system in the United States, where the average person, citizen in the United States, was now sort of looking over there and saying, you know, I think we have a problem in the prison system. We have something to look at. Of course, now it's a huge issue. You know, citizens are keenly aware of what's going on in the prisons and are active and reform and this kind of stuff. Was this a sea change event?
Before the Attica riot, there was very little media or public access to prisons anywhere. You know, and New York State has tended to be one of the more liberal and enlightened places for all kinds of humanitarian issues. But when it came to the prisons, they were just, particularly Attica, it was just a dark hole, you know.
Right.
I mean, they would not allow more than minimal public access. After the riot, that changed. They promised that, you know, that there would be civic groups coming in for counseling, that reporters like me would be guaranteed access to prisoners who agreed to be interviewed, and when the guards went on strike outside the prison and they had no more than a skeletal staff there, they had another tinderbox, and I walked picket line interviewing these guards sometimes all night. You know, they were burning. It was cold. It was winter, and they had fires going and, you know, to stay warm. And there were family members who had, you know, fathers, uncles, whatever, husbands inside the prison who came and stood vigil with the guards there. Mm-hmm. It was another humanitarian tragedy and potential riot about to happen. This time precipitated by the guards, actually.
And it was during that time that you got to know the guards so intimately, sort of began your voyage into the prison,
right,
as it were.
Right. That's where I began to see, you know, the guards and the prisoners' families as human beings with amazing stories to tell. And sort of began, you know, my unintended career as, I guess...
I was going to say, and a huge change in your life, because you would end up spending quite a many years in Attica.
Yeah, I probably
As a journalist,
yeah,
not as,
as an inmate. But I probably spent as much time in Attica as somebody there on a simple burglary charge.
Right, right.
It would be months if you strung it all together.
So going back to the letter, because obviously this is an audio format, we can't see the letter. Can you describe for us what it looks like, the handwriting?
Handwriting, it looks like it's very well spaced out. I can't believe, you know, it's almost exactly.
Because there's no lines on this paper.
There are no lines on the paper, but it looks like it must have been placed on, you know, a ruled or lined sheet below it or somehow, and very, very straight, very clear letters. It is written and not printed, but
cursive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way. And like someone who was maybe trying to do his best in a penmanship class.
And also, it's interesting to note that this, it's only a two-page letter, but the second page is numbered.
Right.
Page
two. A two at the top. Yeah. Attention to detail.
Cool. So take us on to some subsequent letters.
Okay.
So that was about the first, February 7th, 1980. Okay.
And 5 days later, it looks like, on February 12th, he's responding, "Dear Jack, I just got your letter today, and I'm somewhat disappointed that it will be a week or more before I see you. At least this is what your letter seems to indicate." I had to get permission from the prison and from my editors to go in and do these things. Anyhow, the sooner the better. Of course, I would insist that you come for the visit as a reporter and under your reporter status. This way we could take notes and things. Now for some bad news. Superintendent Smith may not be too fond of our visit at this time. However, I have no wish to talk about this recent incident simply because I know nothing about it. I really have no interest in the disturbance whatsoever. So there had been a disturbance inside the prison related to the issues that I had reported on, you know, housing mentally ill prisoners along with
so there'd been an event, an incident of some kind.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's just saying, I want to steer clear of it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Page two, numbered as page two. So please make the superintendent aware that our future meeting will not be about him, this prison, or this recent mess hall incident.
Lots of politics.
Yep. And usually when there's a violent incident, it happens while the guys are all together feeding or in the yard.
Right.
So, and mess hall is always a tinderbox.
When they have the opportunity.
Yep. The mess halls in the prisons are one of the most highly, you know, carefully guarded, you know, maximum. These things are probably what he's fearful of. Jack, all I ask is that you be honest and open with me. I also insist that you be as critical as you see fit to be with regard to my letters to Albany and my ideas. I need someone who will be impartial but reasonable and helpful. Well, I'll hold off on this until we meet. In the meantime, some information will be helpful to me. Perhaps you could have some of the answers when we meet. Page three.
We got some numbered questions here.
Question number one, period. What is the name and address of the film company making the Attica Riot movie? Two, will the movie be based on fact or will it be mostly fiction? Three, has the film company paid the state for the right to film and the use of its property? Four, how much money have the survivors made from the state, the survivors of these guards and inmates who perished? Five, when will the film be shown to the public? Six, get the names and addresses of congressmen and women in your area and around Wyoming County. Just for the thanks! Exclamation point. Sincerely, David Berkowitz.
Now, why is he so concerned about the Attica film? Because he is not involved, correct, in the Attica riot. It's not a film about him. He wasn't there, right? It's before the murders even took place.
Right. It was 1971, and we're in 1980 for this. Big media, you know, big sensationalist Hollywood media was getting involved. And he saw the victims, and I'm sure he was talking to other inmates there too, including probably some who were in Attica at the time of the riots. Mm-hmm. And his whole shtick at that point to remain relevant and give some positive outcome to his horrible crimes was to suddenly become an ombudsman for crime victims.
Okay, so it wasn't limited to just victims of his crimes.
No, this was going. You know, this was a universal.
He had larger plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And this, of course, too, is an example of what we were kind of talking about before, where it's a tit for tat kind of situation. He's giving you something that you want. He's granting you this exclusive interview when no journalist had been inside the prison for a number of years to see him, and he's also wants something in return, right?
Right.
He wants publicity for his campaign, and he wants very specific answers to very specific questions that you would have to do some amount of work to obtain, right? I mean,
right? I didn't.
You don't know this stuff. Right, you have to go out and right. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't involved with any of this filming or anything. I was a totally independent newspaper reporter, mm-hmm. you know, who had been, quite frankly, I was astonished that he made it a point to get in touch with me. I never initiated an outreach to him.
What was the reaction of your editors when you walk in the office and you're like, hey, guess what?
Holy
guess who I just got a letter from?
It was holy shit.
Yeah, I'm sure. Not what they were expecting, I'm
no.
sure.
No.
Wow. Okay. So, I remember what I wanted to ask you when we were reading that letter. What, explain to us what the deal is with, he mentions in both letters, he's very clear about how he wants you to come and what capacity he wants you to visit him in. How do you unpack that? What's going on there?
Clearly, he wanted to use my media position to his own advantage. Mm. He knew that any story I wrote would be picked up by him. I think maybe he viewed me as someone who was not only empathetic with, which I was, with the human rights of men
sure.
inside
inmates,
at Attica prison. And, you know, the guard, being a prison guard is psychologically demanding, tough work. And he wanted to pick my brain about the time that I spent there. Like I said, semi-undercover writing stories and a little bit of my own background in history, mm-hmm. My life, and on some of the tapes on the tape recorder that I brought in, I had accidentally left in a reel that had my then 6 or 7 year old daughter, you know, singing beautiful voice, and he was transfixed, you know. I remember I accidentally started, and he said, oh, let that play. And it was my daughter singing the song, the Marlo Thomas song, I think, Free to Be You and Me. You know, she had the album. And
so uncommon to his world, like an alien coming down.
Nothing like nothing in his life experience. He might have had a little bit of that when he met his half-sister and her family, and, mm-hmm. you know. But he saw that in his sister's life, and I think that's one of the other things that had depressed him to the point that he decided to start killing people, is that he would never be able to have a normal life like his half-sister had with a family. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, if you meet these people, they're monsters when you go in their cages. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to get to know them in any meaningful way about writing their story, you're going to have to reveal your own humanity.
And they become people too, and you have to deal with that. You have to deal with that conflict in your own mind and soul.
Yeah, and there's the question, you know, if it were legal or whatever, or I had the opportunity and I had a gun, would I eliminate this creature from society? Or,
it raises a lot of questions being in their presence. Yeah. Questions that normal people don't have to address.
Right.
And for those of us who have never visited a prison before, and certainly not visited a prison as a journalist, what is the difference? He always, between visiting one way and visiting the other, he almost makes it seem like he said, so we can take notes, right? Is that something that you'd only get access to pen and paper if you were there in a capacity as a journalist?
Exactly. I think if you go in as, you know, a quote, friend of these guys, which you can do just to meet them and get to know them.
Sure.
But you can't take any recording instruments, certainly. No pen, no... The prisoners at that time were allowed to have, I think, one pencil and one sheet of paper. But if I was going in just as his visitor, I could bring a Bible, you know. And maybe one or two other.
So he wanted it documented. He wanted it written down. He wanted it preserved.
He was very clear on, as we just read here, you know, that you are coming in to do interviews with me, and I would like in exchange to know what's going on.
Made that very clear. Yeah. Take us into the next letter. So these basically carry over
1980.
They kind of sort of follow your relationship in that year.
Right. And we had some, back in 79, we had some informal contact, which is the first where he decided to make it official. And yeah, he was calling just about all of the shots, as you...
Right.
As you can imagine.
Right.
These guys are nothing if not control freaks. Okay. This is May 15th, 1980.
So this is after the interviews have begun then.
Right. I had begun doing interviews. I did, what's the date on
the
story here?
The taped interviews start in March of 1980, if I'm not
correct. Right. Right.
Oh, okay.
And I began doing a longer series and, you know, the printout story there, which might not have been published because the newspaper took so much heat when we put this on as our lead story on Sunday when an Olympian had won like 5 gold medals, like, you know.
And there's a photo here that you took of Berkowitz at one of the interviews in Attica. Can you describe that photo for us?
He is
got an interesting
bearded
look on his face.
Bearded, looking thoughtful, resting his head on his hand with his fingers kind of curled. Long sleeve prison green shirt on. And he appears to have a pen in his, a pencil in his left hand.
It's one of the more pensive looks that I've ever seen of him in a photo. Usually he has that, what's become his kind of known, that wry sort of childlike smile.
Right. Right. Yeah, he looks like he could be a poet or a writer here contemplating his next line. Mm-hmm. And
okay, so what happens in this next letter here?
Okay, I know that we did some that I recorded a number of interviews beginning in March with him, And here is letter dated May 15th, 1980. He was writing me at home at this time as opposed to addressing them to my newspaper office.
Okay, so that kind of shows that you have started to become an individual who he knows,
right?
Not just a byline.
Right. And I was agreed, you know, with this sentiment that any publicity that could shed light and help the victims of crime and not encourage others to do what he had done, mm-hmm, would be a good thing.
And it also means that you gave him your home address, which, right, is an interesting thing.
Right.
Because you're also, that's quite a step, right, to give one of these guys your home address. Right.
And probably reveals my own naivety, but...
Because you're also a single father at this time, right? Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Dear Jack, and this letter is typewritten. The others were handwritten. So I suppose he had acquired a typewriter.
Okay.
Somehow.
In that time. Which,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Dear Jack, yesterday afternoon I received your letter dated 5/12/80. Unfortunately, you arrived in the morning and the letter arrived in the afternoon. I am truly sorry about not granting an interview in the past few weeks, but a number of problems have come up. For one, Abrahamson, the psychiatrist to whom he had confided that he was in fact, you know, had concocted the whole Son of Sam fantasy and the demon and the talking dogs and all that, and was in fact quite sane and capable of being very lucid, as he always was with me. For one, Abrahamson now has legal difficulties with Klausner. Klausner is the guy who was writing the unauthorized by Berkowitz story of the murders, and Abrahamson's book was apparently,
right,
you know, and Dr. Abrahamson also wrote him and didn't want him talking to me because he wanted to be the exclusive oracle on Son of Sam,
which is an agreement that David had offered him,
right. The latter will be Klausner. Apparently going after Abrahamson. Klausner has launched a lawsuit of sorts. I think he means sorts here, S-O-U-G-H-T-S.
Okay.
Lawsuit of sorts. And Abrahamson is trying to make a deal. Right now, the best thing that could happen is no news articles concerning anything exclusive from my part. Once Klausner cools down, then Abrahamson will be able to make a deal. Okay, so I didn't realize that Dr. Abrahamson was having legal difficulties, mm-hmm, making his book deal. So between those, they both wanted money from publishers.
Okay. Right.
Klausner, by the way, did see the article which originated from you. Of course, he was most pissed off. Klausner tried to, you know, he was trying to portray himself as the only valid source of information,
gotcha,
about this.
But Klausner did not speak directly with
Berkowitz. Never spoke. Berkowitz never agreed to speak with Klausner. All of his information came from police sources that he possibly...
He's a great researcher. It's incredibly well-researched, that book.
Yeah, I mean, he was obviously a guy who was thick with the police department and, you know, and a New York City boy. He knew every street corner and nook and cranny.
He spoke with everyone.
Yeah.
On both sides.
Yeah. Except for the killer.
Except for Berkowitz.
Yeah.
Correct. Right. Okay.
So, you know, he was the prima donna here. Klausner, by the way, did see the article which originated from you, and of course he was most pissed off. So, okay. Klausner saw the article because several McGraw-Hill executives live in Westchester County, which is Gannett-controlled. Gannett is a newspaper corporation which owned my newspaper. And yes, the Westchester paper is a Gannett paper also.
Oh, okay.
Now, this was before USA Today, but, you know, USA Today is the big Gannett property today. Still, he never complained to me directly, lest I continue to do articles to hurt him. But this isn't why I did the story with you, but he doesn't know this.
Right.
Okay. Anyhow, until all the legal problems have been resolved, I cannot speak with anyone. Incidentally, Playboy did publish my letter in its June 1980 issue. First, they wrote and said that they wouldn't publish it, but 2 weeks later, it appeared. Listen, my head is still in a good place. Nothing has changed with me, and I'm certain that we will meet again. But let me tell you when I'm ready. It will be when all the problems down in New York City have been resolved. Sincerely, David Berkowitz.
And even though it's a typed letter, he signs it there. In ink.
Right. It's signed by him. It is authentic.
And did you meet again? Or were the interviews concluded at that point?
We did. The interviews, my taped interviews, were concluded at that point. But we did meet again after that.
Okay.
Informally.
Right.
Okay, here we go. September 4th. 1980. I think there were probably some missing correspondence here between us.
Oh, okay. So there wasn't actually probably that long of a gap. What's that one?
This is December 27th. Okay. This one is August 7th, 1980.
Okay, oh, there you go.
This would be in between. Again, addressed to my home address. Dear Jack, I was informed that you called the prison to ask if I wanted an interview. I, however, think that it's best for me to slow down now to see just what happens next. I have a New York-based attorney who has expressed interest in this case, so I want to be careful not to scare him off. If I lose him, then I'd be hurting. Anyhow, as you can see, I was correct about the McGraw-Hill book. Just as I had predicted, the book is nothing more than an exploitive, sensationalistic money-making scheme.
And this is David Clausers. Talking, of course.
Yeah. This is Berkowitz critiquing Klausner's book. However, what can I do next? Of course, my biggest fear is that all the publicity that I'm giving to the book may cause it to sell even better than if I left it alone. Let me say at this time, I may do an interview with you, but only under two circumstances. That your newspaper doesn't run it on the front page with banner headlines, which we both got a lot of heat from.
Okay. Why is that?
Because he was so reviled by people reading newspaper stories at that time, and the way that the editors chose to run it, because it was an exclusive story no one else had.
Sure.
It was stripped across the front page of the Sunday newspaper with his photo that I had taken. And we bumped down below that the 5 gold medals that were won by an American in the Olympics.
And people were upset.
And people were very upset at the editorial judgment used to, you know.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, let me say at this time, I may do an interview with you, and he underlines the word may in ink. It's a typewritten letter, but only under two circumstances. That your newspaper doesn't run it on the front page with banner headlines. That you don't probe the crimes in themselves. If you could arrange something like this, then I may consent. And I don't recall for sure, but I'm sure that I didn't agree to that because I would have been making a decision that only my editors could have made.
Okay.
So, truthfully, what kind of spooked me was your interest in the crimes and how you wanted me to detail them. This turned me right off. Much too painful and sensitive. Please, I just can't be rehashing the tragedy all the time. Hope to hear from you. Sincerely, signed and inked, David Berkowitz. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.